This week on From the Vault Remembered, we'll be listening to Lord Bertrand Russell. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, Director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. The Bertrand Russell Papers are held at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Dr. Andrew Bone, the Senior Research Associate at the Bertrand Russell Research Center, joined us by phone to talk a bit about Lord Russell's work, his beliefs, his writings, and Dr. Bone's own work on him.
It seems that the recordings of which you're in possession are from Russell's anti-nuclear phase of political activity in the 1950s and 60s, when he had become was a leader of the British Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, which was established in 1958. And after which Russell became increasingly radical and uncompromising in the politics of anti-nuclear protest that he adopted, having initially been tied to the sort of legal constitutional method of protest of CND, he eventually, by the early 60s, is coming to favor more militant forms of nonviolent protest, and this led to a split in CND, and Russell was at the heart of this very controversial phase in the politics of the British anti-nuclear movement, and came to be one of the founders of the so-called Committee of 100.
And the CND, Andrew, is the Complete Nuclear Disarmament? Is
the that Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
Okay, Campaign.
A British organization, but one which had, there were equivalent organizations throughout the West. In the United States, even, we had the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Politics, involving people such as the socialist leader Norman Thomas, with whom Russell corresponded, and other prominent people on the anti-war left. I think it's worth mentioning in terms of Russell's anti-nuclear politics how his thinking about nuclear weapons had been transformed. His first public statement about nuclear weapons was in the aftermath of Hiroshima in November 1945, and it's clear that Russell, the man who'd popularized atomic science for many people in the interwar period, had a very keen grasp of what the implications of this frightful new weapon were. And in a very sort of clear parliamentary statement, seemed to anticipate some of the future developments that took place over the following decade, the development of thermonuclear as opposed to mere fission weapons, of the kind that had been used against Japan at the end of World War II. But Russell wasn't, at this stage of his political life, a critic of the nuclear policy of the West. Far from it. In fact, for 4 or 5 years after the war, in what has been slightly misleadingly labeled his preventive war phase, Russell was a very orthodox Cold Warrior, and prepared to contemplate, if not to urge, the use of nuclear weapons once again, should the Cold War with the Soviet Union turn hot. What was the critical turning point for Russell was when the Soviet Union themselves acquired an atomic bomb in August 1949, when it was first successfully tested. And that, for Russell, decisively changed the rules of the Cold War game. It wasn't a posture that the aggressive Cold War posture that he adopted. It wasn't one that he slipped into that uneasily, because he'd been a critic of the Soviet Union from the very at least from the time he went to visit that country in 1920, and this was a persistent and constant theme of his politics. But with both sides in the early 1950s equipped with expanding nuclear arsenals, Russell now believed that a different way out of the Cold War impasse had to be found. And I've mentioned the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. That was, and after that, the Committee of 100. Prior to that, Russell was gradually immersing himself in work for peace, not to the exclusion of his philosophical and other interests, but it certainly became the major priority in his public activities. Prior to CND, he'd been instrumental in launching this initiative of scientists, which led to a very famous declaration drafted by Russell, co-signed with Einstein immediately before Einstein's death in 1959, called the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, which was essentially a warning from eminent men of science from both sides of the Iron Curtain about just how horrific a nuclear war would be and possible tentative first steps to take towards establishing détente and beyond that disarmament if possible.
Here is Lord Bertrand Russell speaking personally about his life and work in 1970.
Human beings, ever since their fathers invented language, have allowed themselves to be dominated by tradition. This has been at once the main cause of progress and the main obstacle to progress. Consider it first as a cause of progress. Where should we be if each generation had to invent reading, writing, and arithmetic for itself? How should we get on if arts and crafts are not handed on? Even in the most progressive age, much the greater part of our activity is and must be based upon tradition. We may rebel against our parents' narrow-mindedness, but we can only rise above them by standing on their shoulders. But although respect for tradition and obedience to custom are necessary up to a point, most societies have carried them much too far, and some have brought themselves to destruction by this sole defect. Human beings change their ways much more quickly than animals do. Civilized men change their ways more quickly than uncivilized men, and modern civilized men change their ways more quickly than civilized men of former ages. Civilized societies during the last 150 years have radically transformed their physical environment, the methods by which they secure a livelihood, and the apparatus of comfort over and above the minimum necessary for survival. The prime cause of these changes has been a vast increase of knowledge and skill. The new techniques in the material realm demand, if they are to bring their full benefit in increase of human welfare, an accompaniment of new mental habits. It is in this respect more than in any other that our world falls short. In an age of machines and skilled scientific production, we retain the feelings and many of the beliefs that were appropriate to the ages of scarcity and primitive agriculture. The need of new political and social ideas is due to our increase of efficiency, both for good and evil. In the old days, many things that are now possible could not be achieved by any known means. Extreme poverty, for the great majority, was unavoidable. Population, perpetually pressed upon the limits of subsistence, except when it was catastrophically diminished by famine or pestilence. Wars created aristocracies of conquerors who lived without compunction upon the labor of the vanquished. It was not until the French Revolution that this system began to be superseded by one involving less general misery. Now, in certain important Western countries, extreme poverty has almost disappeared. Famine is unknown, large-scale pestilences have yielded to medical science, and a low birth rate has made it possible to preserve a high level of prosperity when it has been reached. All this is new in human history. Struggle, fight, starvation, and premature death have been the lot of the great majority of human beings ever since there were human beings, just as they were the lot of the animals before them. The fundamental source of this beneficent revolution is scientific production and the scientific habit of mind which has given rise to it. Two other things, besides scientific methods of production, have been necessary, namely democracy and a low birth rate. But these by themselves would not have been sufficient and would scarcely have been possible without science, except for brief periods in exceptional circumstances. sufficient to produce a happy community. They are necessary. And machine industry without them may lead to a new form of serfdom, quite as dreadful as anything in the gloomy annals of the past. We hear much about the Western way of life and the need of defending it against the Eastern menace. But few in the West are clear as to the essentials of the Western way of life, or as to what makes it worth defending. If we were clear about this, our propaganda would be more effective, and we should have less need than we have at present to depend upon military might as our sole protection. What the West has discovered, though as yet the realization is incomplete, is a method by which practically everybody can have as much of material goods as is conducive to happiness, without excessive hours of labor, and with that degree of mental culture that is needed to make leisure delightful. This is rendered possible by the fact that one man's work can now produce much more than is required for one man's subsistence. But as yet, this system has only a precarious life. It is threatened from without by those whom envy renders destructive, when it is threatened from within by those who are still under the domination of beliefs and passions appropriate to a bygone age. The kernel of these beliefs and passions is the struggle for life. Where this struggle is now still necessary, it is necessary because men are misguided, not because nature is niggardly. In former times, if two men each wished to live on the produce of a piece of land which only yielded enough for one, they must either both starve or fight till one was killed. In practice, it was not single men who fought, but groups of men, called successively tribes, nations, coalitions, or united nations. These considerations apply to the present East-West tension. The Russians believe, whether sincerely or not, that they can only prosper by first ruining the West. The West, not unnaturally, concludes that it can only survive by first ruining Russia. I will not for a moment deny that while these reciprocal sentiments exist, they make themselves true. If A and B each know that the other is after him with a pistol, they may consider general maxims about the desirability of cooperation irrelevant. The question for each reduces itself to the very simple one, which of us will kill the other first? But the difference between their interests is caused by their sentiments, not by any external natural cause. And so it is with the public entities in the modern world. They have no justification in economic fact or sober self-interest, but results solely from the surviving pugnacity of mankind, which once served a purpose that is now merely antiquated. If Russia and the West each became convinced that the other had no hostile intentions, each would be spared all the expense of arms, each would derive benefits from reciprocal commerce, each would escape from the dread of the atomic bomb and the destruction of large parts of the population. The motives of self-interest, which on each side promote hostile feeling, are merely a reflection of the exactly identical motives of self-interest of the other side, and are based on each side upon the assumption that the other side is irrationally inclined. Of course, human nature being what it is, this naked analysis would seem shocking to both sides. For wherever hostility exists, however obsolete may be its sources, it appears on both sides as a great moral crusade, in which it is the duty of every true man to uphold high ethical ideals. But all this is merely a part of the psychological camouflage by which Homo sapiens conceals from himself his own lack of wisdom. We cannot blame governments for our troubles, nor can they be cured by merely governmental action. What is needed is a change in the ordinary outlook of ordinary people. The change that is wanted is sometimes thought to be a moral change, but my own belief is that nothing is required beyond a just estimate of self-interest. I know that it is difficult to rouse enthusiasm as such a view. Suppose you said to a population, if you pursue course A, half of you will die in agony and the other half will live in squalor. Whereas, if you pursue course B, you will all prosper. And suppose that on this basis you conducted a great political campaign. What do you think would happen? All the earnest moralists would rise up and say, sir, your aims are base. There are more important things than material prosperity. Should a great nation shrink from suffering if it is incurred in a noble cause? Was it by such degraded self-seeking that our ancestors made our nation great? Perish the thought. Away with money grubbers. Let us live like heroes. And if fate so wills it, die like heroes. You will find that you are completely powerless against mass hysteria so generated. You will find men pointing the finger of scorn at you as a coward. And you will be lucky if your cowardice does not lead to your being lynched, while the thousands who are lynching you contrast their inflexible courage with your baseball trumpery. The popular fear of intelligence is one of the great dangers of our times. If teachers and educational authorities had more understanding of this sort of person, of the sort of person the modern world needs, they could, within a generation, produce an outlook that would transform the world. But their idea of character is an old-fashioned one. They admire most the sort of character which would give a man leadership in a gang of pirates. And if you say that commerce is a different thing from piracy, they think you are soft and hope you are mistaken. All this is due to the persistence of old martial ideas that have descended to us from earlier ages. These ideas, I repeat, were appropriate to an age of unavoidable scarcity, but are not applicable to our own times, when whatever scarcity still exists is due to human stupidity and to nothing else. Consider the application of such a mentality to international banking, and you will not be surprised by the Great Depression which it produced while it reigned unchecked, nor by the belief of the Nazis that the depression would be curbed if only enough Jews were exterminated, nor by the Russian belief that we should all be rich if all the rich men were liquidated. None of these mistakes would have been made by men in whom intelligence was capable of controlling passion. None of them would have been made by men who understood that when different groups have different interests, it is because of unwise passions and not because of any physical fact. If we are to live happily with a modern technique, and it is possible for modern technique to bring a far higher level of happiness than was formerly possible, we must banish certain ideas and substitute certain others. For love of domination, we must substitute justice. For brutality, we must substitute intelligence. For competition, we must substitute cooperation. We must learn to think of the human race as one family and further our common interests by the intelligent use of natural resources, marching together towards prosperity, not separately towards death and destruction. The mental change required is difficult and will not be achieved in a moment. But if the need is recognized by educators, and if the young are brought up as citizens of this world and not of a bygone world of predatory warriors, the change can be achieved within a generation, so that we may hope to save at least a portion of mankind from the universal destruction with which we are threatened by the pursuit of obsolete ideas.
I'm here with Dr. Andrew Bone, the Senior Research Associate at the Bertrand Russell Research Center at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada.
And Andrew, can you tell us a little bit about what intrigues us is his religious beliefs and how that infused his politics and his work in philosophy?
Yeah, well, Russell was a famous... his thinking about religion was formed in his adolescence when he experienced a classic Victorian crisis of faith and remained agnostic I think, more or less atheist for the remainder of his life. But and was also, his criticism of religion manifested itself in a number of ways, more conventionally as a critic of the institutional side of religion, of, say, Roman Catholic policy on birth control, for example, of the insistence of various denominations on censorship of matters relating to sexual morality. Russell, of course, fell foul of such thinking when he was in the United States for most of the Second World War period, and when his appointment to teach philosophy at City College of New York was blocked by a sort of unholy holy alliance of religious groups in New York City, who objected to Russell's record as an advocate of divorce and as a man who'd written controversial things about marriage and sexual morality in actually many years previously, in the late 1920s. Russell also, engaged his critique of religion, also had a philosophical bent. He kind of engaged the arguments for the existence of God and tried in various writings to demolish those one by one. Most famously, in his short pamphlet published in the 20s called "Why I'm Not a Christian," later reprinted in a work of similar essays, which was of the same title, published in the 1950s. And it was certainly, as much as his politics, a part of his overall outlook, which tended to land him in trouble throughout what was a very long public life. There were various rumors that circulated when Russell was very old to the effect that he had actually, in fact, embraced religion of some kind. And he was at pains, even in his 90s, to scotch such rumors. So he remained a very adamant and convinced agnostic throughout his life.
I wanted to ask kind of a side note more. Sure. On his personal background. From doing research on him and reading in his autobiography, I wanted to ask, how do you think the discovery of his that his mother was having an intimate relationship with his brother's tutor, and that his father knew about it, and then the battle that ensued after both of his parents passed away, with his grandparents trying to battle for custody, how do you think that affected his views on relationships and marriage as an adult? Because he was married some four times and seemed to not have very traditional viewpoints on relationship and marriage.
Yeah. The whole issue of Russell's early life and its bearing on his development as an adult is an interesting one. I can only offer a sort of tentative view. I think the incident you mentioned about Russell's tutor and his mother is worth going into in a bit of detail. The tutor, I believe it was a man called D.A. Spaulding, was tubercular and was dying, and Russell's parents, who themselves were very progressive for their day. Russell's father stood in a by-election for Parliament in Britain and had no chance of winning the seat because his controversial advocacy of birth control entered into the domain of the electoral contest. They were very progressive in their views on the rights of women. In the mid 19th century, advocates of female suffrage, of equal rights of inheritance, of freeing the professions for women, which remained blocked at that time. So that was the kind of milieu in which his parents were a part, the sort of progressive liberal intelligentsia, with an added component of their aristocratic social connections. Russell's childhood, after his parents both died before he was the age of four, was not a particularly happy one. and the contrast between his parents' views and those of the rather stern and severe Scottish grandmother, who was primarily responsible for his upbringing at Pembroke Lodge in Richmond in London, couldn't be more starker. You mentioned Russell's sort of storied marital history. I think that Russell was ahead of his time in the advocating what he was advocating in marriage and morals, essentially divorce on demand, sexual experimentation before marriage, even consensual extramarital relations within. I think that the kind of things that he was advocating were, and I'm not making a judgment on whether this was a good or a bad thing. I think it's quite possible to see Russell as both a sort of hero and villain, depending on one's perspective here. As somebody who was a precursor of the kind of liberalization that took place in the 1960s in the United States, in Britain. And Russell, having written widely on those kind of social issues, as well as on the nuclear peril, and latterly in the 60s as a man who was a very fierce scourge of the Vietnam War as well, Russell was both attractive to a younger generation in the 60s because of his stand on the Vietnam War, because of his stand on nuclear weapons. He was at the center of debates at which the youthful generation of the 60s was at the heart. And also, that kind of meshed nicely with some of the things that he'd been saying for decades on social and cultural issues.
We've been talking to Andrew Bone, the Senior Research Associate at the Bertrand Russell Research Center at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thank you, Andrew, for joining us. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials of Lord Bertrand Russell we used, go online at fromthevaultradio.org or call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 800-735-0230. This week's program was produced and written by Alan Carman and Christopher Sprinkle. We used music in this week's episode by Pink Floyd from the 1983 album written by Roger Waters entitled The Final Cut, A Requiem for the Postwar Dream. From the Vault, the series, is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres, production coordinator Edgar Toledo, outreach by Sean Dulles, accounting by Mariana Berkovich, and customer service by Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers Joseph Falasca, Karen Anonia, and Ray Bereka. If you're in the Los Angeles area and would like to volunteer on From the Vault, please go to our website and find out how. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. For more information on him, his music, and other music used within the program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself, Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.